Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gorbani. Hi, Shireen.
Hey, and Happy New Year.
And on the political right, Senator Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hi, everybody. It is good to be back.
Listen, Dan, I want to start out today's program. It's been about 1 year now since January 6th. That's the anniversary of when a group of Trump supporters basically attacked the U.S. Capitol. They were trying to overturn the 2020 election, or at least protesting what they thought was a lie that the election had actually been stolen for Joe Biden. I've been watching the coverage, kind of seeing it, thinking about it, looked at a lot of footage, heard a lot of commentary. And Dan, I just want to hear, how does this play for the Republican Party, this anniversary and all of the news that's coming out about the event?
Do you want to know how it plays for the Republican Party? I can tell you really easily. When you have groups like Nancy Pelosi saying, hey, I got a great idea, let's come up with a memorial plaque in the Capitol and on the Mall that reminds everybody of the January 6th attack. When the Democrats see it as that big of an opportunity, it tells you it can't be positive. For the Republican Party,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It can't be.
Well, you have images of, you know, Capitol Police being attacked. The one that hurts me the most is international governments and the horror that they feel in seeing American government being overrun. It's so diminishing to our national pride, Shireen.
I think often about, Natalie, your words that, you know, democracy is fragile. And I think you used the example that somebody else had said of a Fabergé egg, right? Mm-hmm. That this is something that's delicate. It needs to be protected. We're in a situation where I do think people need to understand January 6th as a failed coup attempt. And what that is practice to do it. And there are signs that the Republican Party in some states are trying to set the groundwork so that it becomes possible to overturn an election in our next cycle. We're seeing that with really disturbing moves to change who's responsible for certifying the vote, how electors are slated. The actual mechanics of how that day went down are being challenged in states across this country. So if you don't believe that what happened on January 6th was a trial run, look to some of the legislation that we're seeing across this country to understand the groundwork is absolutely being laid for something like this to work. And I think that's terrifying. Mm.
You know, one of the things I think is so interesting is that there's this sentiment in the public that our democracy's, at risk. In a crisis mode, at the risk of failing. And what's interesting is Democrats think it's failing for one reason and Republicans think it's failing for another. And that's what's really dangerous about it is we're not even agreeing on just basic facts. Dan, I don't want to, you know, transition to the filibuster too quickly, but I do in the sense that to me, a lot of this is laying the groundwork for a decision that's going to be made very soon, probably on Martin Luther King Day, about overturning the filibuster for the voting rights legislation.
Yeah. You have one of probably the biggest federal overreaches of, like, you know, power into the states. And obviously the Democrats want it to pass. And they want it so that they can, you know, I guess, implement their way of looking at things. And so that's their whole MO. They're going to just have run it from the federal government and that's it. And Shireen's going to say, well, it's all about fairness and it's all about this and that. Really, that's not what it is. If you look through what the Voting Rights Act is, almost, I can't remember what the percentage was or if it even matters, but most of it Utah is already doing. The only things we're not doing is automatic voter registration. And I think that's a minor issue. When you look at it, the hardest thing we have right now or the biggest problem we have from a voter fraud element is that we send out ballots to people who don't live here in the state anymore. And so automatic voter registration would actually double down on that problem.
Mm-hmm. Shireen, let's hear your commentary, you know, about Dan's, particularly his comment that this is federal overreach.
Yeah. So what I would say is, you know, what Dan's saying that this is all about is federal overreach. But what I would say it's about is that Democrats, for us, we believe that it should be easy to vote in this country. And there is very good legislation that's been vetted, some written by some of our most conservative Democrats across the aisle with members of the Republican Party. But we cannot get movement on protecting voting rights. And in fact, what we were seeing 2 years ago, last year, was over 200 bills across the nation where voting rights were being restricted. And, you know, Dan, I do think you're right. We have actually incredibly, I think, progressive voting laws and voting systems here in Utah. The way that we approach it is incredibly forward thinking, especially vote by mail. But what we're seeing right now is that there is serious conversation about moving back to, there are people in the state moving forward on trying to move back to paper ballots and really trying to make it harder and harder to vote. And what we know is that those who are most disproportionately impacted by that are people who move a lot, who typically tend to be poorer. People of color are more often impacted by those kinds of changes. And that is the pattern that we're seeing across this country, unfortunately, often led by Republican legislatures.
That is so broad of a statement and so way over the top that it's really hard to just stay silent. All of the, like, it tends to affect the statistics, like, it's just ridiculous. Look, this really comes down to some people think that we really, and I wonder about this trend, and I was actually debating this with a friend of mine earlier, that pretty soon we're going to have a choice as a country really to decide if elected democracy is even working for us anymore. And I say that because, you know, ease of voting, right? If you employ ease of voting, you could legitimately make it so that somebody could vote through their phone on bills that Congress would like to run. Why would you even need a representative form of government? And if that's the direction we're going, which I think is actually where Democratic policies are really trying to take us, which is do away with representative government altogether. And maybe that's disruptive enough for them, and maybe that's what they will be okay with. I don't know that making it easier to vote is, you know, is a bad thing. I would say, you know, having the federal government kick into politicians' campaign accounts so that taxpayers are making contributions to politicians, that's a big part of the Voting Act. So I just say there are lots of problems with that bill, and yet Democrats want to ram it through. And I'm just telling you, the unintended consequences of what they're proposing have far-reaching impacts to our democracy.
Okay, I just have
and
to say,
potentially worse.
Your position is that what I said was over the top and then totally took us on a tangent towards a vision of democracy that no one in my party is actually talking about or running legislation on.
No, while that's not true.
What
if you
I'm
go through San Francisco
is
right
actually
now,
happening
you talk through Tech
right
Valley
now
Palo Alto,
by your party.
That is what they're talking about. Palo Alto is right now talking about ways to use blockchain to get rid of popular voting, and it is why they're tired of, quote, the conservative masses telling them in California what they should do. I'm telling you, it is truly threatening to our system.
Dan,
now, maybe that's okay
for
Dan,
people. You know, it's so interesting to me when I listen to any of these narratives, because what I think about, as I understand it, legislation passed at the state level that precludes people from voting, you know, on the weekends or on Sundays. Is there, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's what I've read and heard. And I just think that that's crazy. I think of hardworking Americans who have a tough time going to the ballot box, and we got to make it easier to vote. It's not about overthrowing representative government. It's about giving people access to the ballot. And
that's right.
It just seems.
And I don't think anybody's against any of those things, Natalie. I think what you say is if you want to go and like make voting simpler, I'm down. What you got to do is make sure that the person who is voting is, one, authorized to vote, and two, that it's the same person, right? Mm-hmm. That, and so the one thing that's not part of this whole deal that I think would actually solve the problem for 99% of Republicans, it is make sure that you have authorized people voting and that you have the person that's voting is the right person. But the Freedom to Vote Act, I can't remember, yeah, it's Freedom to Vote Act, that completely overlooks all of the security components that the Republicans are asking for and only gives the Democratic wish list. And that's the problem with the bill.
So a different group than what we're talking about, because it's local, but we do have a ballot initiative, Secure Vote Utah, right? That's trying to end mail-in balloting, no more early voting, absentee ballot restrictions. This one, and it turns out it's really costly to do this. That's the latest news about it. But this is an example where I think we should be heading in the direction of modernizing election systems as opposed to digging in the past and being a paper show up on the day of the election kind of vote. Dan, your quick comment there, and Shireen, and then we'll probably take a break.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons why citizen initiatives are tough, right? I'm certain that maybe there's a few things in there that are meaningful and helpful to the process. But then once you add some of the other personal beliefs to it, it gets messy. It will be interesting to see how that one goes forward. It really will be.
Shireen, I know how you'll feel.
Yeah, I don't like it. It's also incredibly costly. It's incredibly expensive to move in this direction. And again, back to Dan's previous point, there's a lot that Utah's doing right in this space, and I would hate to see us move backward.
Yeah. Just for our listeners, the fiscal note is that it would cost local governments a total of $36.8 million in one-time costs and another $19.2 million afterwards to return back to paper ballots, something we haven't done since 1986 in this state exclusively. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We're going to take a short break and come back. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and Dan McKay.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about elections and January 6th. And I hate it, but we have to talk about COVID, Dan and Shireen. The pandemic is calling the shots. It continues to do that with the economy, with our own health. And I'm not one of those that is religiously following case counts. And I'm also not one of those that sees case counts as the be-all, end-all. Like, I'm really interested in deaths and hospitalizations and how they compare to case counts. But when I heard that we hit 7,247 new cases in one day, I remember being shocked at 800. And this is orders of magnitude higher. Wow. Shireen?
Yeah, this is an incredibly troubling time. And I know a lot's going on, but for example, I was running an errand today and just saw massive lines waiting, people trying to get tested. I know that it's very difficult to find the rapid tests at home. And, you know, this is a moment, again, where I'll just ask people to continue to have grace and have conversations with people in their lives who remain unvaccinated. We are still seeing that those individuals are the ones who are at greatest risk when we're looking at and individuals who are immunocompromised or otherwise have complex health problems. But the thing that's kind of scary, I think, about this is Omicron is much more contagious. It does seem, though, that the impact of it on individuals' health seems to be less. So that's good. And I think that's why maybe you're mentioning that number, while shocking, might not mean as many, you know, people who are that ill. But what we know is that there are still people out there who are at high risk that are being significantly impacted by this. We know schools are being impacted. We're seeing a lot of teachers out. Airlines over the holidays, I traveled, we saw the impacts there. And I continue to know that we are incredibly strained in our healthcare system. And all of those things are concerning to me. So even though it's less, that maybe the impacts of it are a little bit less on individuals' health overall, when you have so many people, that surge captures a group of people that are going to be critically ill. And that is a problem for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. Dan, how's this playing on the eve of a legislative session where we're seeing these high positivity rates?
You know, the crazy thing is, this is a, you know, pre-session, right? So as opposed to last time, it was post-session, right? At the end of the session, we got, you know, the first outbreak. Boy, the numbers are, you know, the 7,000 case number. I mean, that is a staggering number. Like you said, I'm with you, Natalie. Like, the small
That's
numbers.
Big.
I remember 100 used to be like, whoa.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think this is, and I think this is everybody saying we were done with COVID in the first variant, and we're not going to let this like change our lives. And it's clear that like, even with the booster, I mean, I now have two friends that are both completely boosted, and I don't know if that's a verb, but they're completely, you know, they're completely vaccinated. And they just got COVID, right? And so this variant is just showing that it is stubborn. And it kind of, there's a friend of mine who back in the very, you know, early stages of the first outbreak of COVID, he said to me, he said, you know, I think maybe COVID has just decided that it's going to get to everyone, whether they like it or not. And it kind of is starting to feel that that was unfortunately
it's
prophetic.
Coming. It also has that mathematics of it's exponential in the rise and it'll be exponential in the decline. And so where are we, you know, on the rise? But the other thing that I find so interesting about it is the first quarter GDP estimates of all the forecasters were around 5%, you know, so an annualized increase, and anything over 3% is really good. So 5 was big. They've now revised those down to 2. This is changing consumer sentiment. The new consumer sentiment index for Utah just came out. It's not even public yet, but I've seen it, the number. And we're down. We're down again 2 months in a row now. So it's really affecting people. Interesting.
And I have to say, I think that there's just a frustration, and I think this is across, you know, many people, kind of feeling a lot of the frustration that people were feeling when this first started, like there wasn't a plan. And I do think what I'm hearing and what I'm feeling is as we return to schools, that there weren't rapid tests available, that we don't really seem to have a lot of communication from our leaders, and that there isn't really kind of the sense that we're still all in this together and we have to kind of keep trying to do our best. I think tensions are running high and people are frustrated, and we need some messages of encouragement from leaders, and even better, some actions to suggest that we're taking this seriously.
Dan and Shireen, a little change of direction, but we've had some very high profile deaths in the last little bit. Desmond Tutu, is it Betty White, John Madden, Harry Reid. I thought an interesting way to talk about it is to focus on a lesson that we've learned from one of these elders. And I thought it was so interesting. Our producer shared with us a quote from Harry Reid. So, of course, the Nevada Democrat that was Senate Majority Leader. He was the Senate Majority Leader when I was in Washington. He died at age 82. Very powerful man. He was LDS. That might be interesting to some of our listeners. But he said he voted to authorize the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2002, and he was asked about it, and he said it was a horrible mistake. And then he said, it tainted my heart. It was the wrong thing to do, but I was sucked in by General Colin Powell and others, and I believe them. So I regret that. Yes, I do. But I thought, there's something to learn, right? That an elected official made a rare acknowledgement, at least in his mind, of a mistake. Dan, did you respect that in the good senator?
Yeah, I mean, he acknowledges a mistake and blames it on someone else. That's a key politician thing to do, right? I won't say that that's Republican or Democrat. That's
I
just
think he was saying I have
does.
Rapport for Colin Powell, and
yeah, and I can get that because Colin Powell is well respected,
and we also lost
for a lot of reasons.
You know, Secretary Powell. You know, yeah, I mean, I know that was a little bit while longer, but he's pointing to it. Someone who's not passed.
I guess I'm more sad about Betty White. Like, I thought the lady was an absolute class act from a, you know, personal comedic standpoint. And I am going to miss her old lady humor in all kinds of things. And she was kind of the go-to lady. It was awesome. I mean, some people don't realize there was a Tracy Jordan skit in 30 Rock. Tracy Jordan says he calls up Betty White just to make sure she was still alive because, you know, he was just checking in, and she answered the phone. She's like, no, I'm not going to be the third person because, you know, in Hollywood, there's always the rule of threes. She just had such a funny way about her. Anyways, more than politicians,
that.
I'm going to miss somebody who makes me laugh.
Yeah. Shireen and Dan, since we last spoke, we had these devastating wildfires in Colorado. And I had to double check the numbers multiple times. I'm like, no, not 600 homes, not 1,000 homes and businesses. And you just couldn't comprehend it. And the pictures, And we can chat about that, but it has this climate touch. And we have our Speaker of the House, Brad Wilson, who held a summit this week on the Great Salt Lake, our very troubled lake that also has a climate connection to drought. Shireen, I'd love to hear you comment on what Speaker Wilson did in convening a summit and talking about some of the solutions.
Yeah, so there has been a lot of attention. Also, the Great Salt Lake was named the Utah of the Year by the Salt Lake Tribune. There's been quite a bit of reporting and activism and people getting organized around really what's going on with the lake. The lake is shrinking, and as it shrinks, it becomes saltier and saltier, and that creates a lot of problems with toxic dust around the edge of the lake, what that impact may have to our, well, what it is already having and could have long-term to our snowpack. It could be devastating to our economy. And there are many ties and ties into the ecological environment right there at the lake site as well. So I'm really grateful to see our Speaker trying to, you know, draw attention to this and pulling together really the attention that this issue deserves and trying to really understand what are the solutions. So I'm not exactly sure what's fully being proposed at this point, but my understanding is that there an initial step is just drawing attention and getting people focused on what really are going to be the long-term impacts if this lake goes away, and then trying to start to work to build some mitigation responses into the next few years. It's going to be critical to act fast.
Yeah, every public policy step begins with conversations. And, you know, interestingly, Dan, that some of the, I mean, in the reporting, we learned that all of the magnesium produced in the U.S. comes from the Great Salt Lake, every bit of it. Over a million migratory birds along the Pacific Flyway that feed there. And then I love this one, 40% of the world's supply of brine shrimp, which is used for fish food for shrimp.
Yeah. You know, a summit like this has a great way of drawing attention to big issues, right? And I'm hopeful that people pay attention. It is going to make lawmakers really uncomfortable, because you've got to balance the rights of a whole bunch of people and a whole bunch of birds, as we just talked about, and a whole bunch of brine shrimp, as we're trying to figure out how to balance those needs and the needs of, like, you know,
a growing population
in their lawn.
A growing population.
And yada, yada, yada. And golf courses, right?
Dan, you used to be
in the ski industry that's being negatively impacted by what's happening now.
Yeah.
Dan, you used to be in the House. Representative Tim Hawks looms large here. He's a leader here. I think he represents Clearfield. Am I getting that right? But anyway, Davis County. But
yes, he's Davis.
But one thing I'd love your commentary on, it's actually more typical for a governor to lead on something like this than it is for legislators. And so that's just a little political angle. Yeah. Is there any light you'd shed there?
I just say, you know, if you're a governor during a pandemic and you're trying to focus on everything, I'll just say it's going to be hard for you to get everything done. Right. And so I'll give the governor a little cover, I guess, in this. And I'd give the speaker the same thing and just say, hey, the speaker really cares about the issue because it's in his backyard. I mean, literally, he lives right by the lake. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a very prescient issue. And I think, you know, it's an appropriate way to kind of draw big attention to the issue. And I know the governor supports the speaker in the measure. And I think we can actually get some solutions if we start focusing on it now.
Yeah. Dan and Shireen, and I'll go to you first, Shireen, but we have a really troubling email that came from the co-founder of Entrada, Dave Bateman. It was an anti-Semitic email that I don't even want to restate what was said in it, but it's caught a lot of attention. This is gentleman's a tech entrepreneur. He's been a GOP fundraiser. And basically tried to say that Jews are behind the COVID-19 vaccines, and it's a sadistic effort to euthanize the American people. Just something very absurd. Your commentary, Shireen.
Yeah, I would just, you know, say I was grateful to see a number of leaders step forward across our state and really, you know, denounce this kind of anti-Semitic language. It sounds like this is something he's been going on, a tangent he's been on for quite a while. I don't think this is, you know, a person that is in... A lot of people are sort of saying it seems like some bigger thing is happening with this individual, but I have to say that this kind of language is unfortunately not that uncommon right now, but it's really disappointing to see somebody with this kind of leadership and access to power espousing these ideas.
Yeah. Dan, what'd you make of it? Did you get the email, by the way, because it came to a lot of Republican leaders?
I did not get the email. I just don't subscribe to a lot of folks. But I can tell you, you know, like how at Thanksgiving when, you know, that uncle comes out of, you know, the restroom or whatever and just has some idea that they've been, you know, thinking up and it isn't really fully thought through and it could ruin like Thanksgiving dinner if you pay too much attention to it. And that's kind of how I feel about this statement, right? Where it's like, well, clearly it doesn't seem to be based on fact. I don't have any evidence to support it, and I haven't heard any other evidence to support it. And so I'm just not going to focus on it because at the end of the day, it's just going to get filed away in history and be gone.
Yeah. And I just say as we close out the program that at now, more than any other time with all we've been through with the pandemic and everything, let's try and get to a positive place. Let's get to a place of grace for people. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been with Dan McKay and Shireen Gorbani. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for your interest, and stay safe.